Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
The economic news of this week and looking ahead to the Fed meeting next week. Plus, ponies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, July the 21st. Good to have you with us. Lots of economic news out this week. We'll get to some housing data in a bit. But honestly, who cares about this week when next week we have another Fed meeting coming up and all the cool kids want to know what the members of the Federal Open Market Committee are going to do about interest rates. To chat about all this and more, I'm joined by official cool kids, Jordan Holman at The New York Times and Kate Davidson at Bloomberg. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kimberly.
Even though it's hot, you're still cool kids. I love it. Kate, I want to start with you. You know, in previous meetings, the Fed has said that every decision is going to be data dependent. What data are they looking at and what story is it telling right now?
Sure. So they're obviously looking at inflation data, right? You know, they're continuing to wage this battle against inflation. And even though there has been recent progress on this front, it's probably not enough. We were almost certainly not enough to get them to back off of what seems to be the plan at their meeting next week, which is to raise rates by another quarter percentage point. Nevertheless, the trend is certainly heading in the right direction. And there are certainly some members of the Federal Open Market Committee, that's the committee of officials that sets interest rates, that think that they're pretty close to a stopping point. So inflation, was 3% in June, which is down from a high of 9.1% about a year ago. So it's come a long way. What officials are still concerned about is so-called core inflation. When you strip out volatile categories like energy and food, it's higher than they'd like it to be, and there's signs that it's not coming down all that much. Also, the job market is still very strong. We saw another strong jobs report that came out since they met the last time. So that's going to be enough to keep them on track to raise rates at least one more time, maybe another time through the rest of the year.
And Jordan, does it feel like sort of there's a unified message coming out of the economy right now that can push the Fed in one direction or another?
Well, so I look at the retail sector of it, and there is still also strong growth, or there is growth in the retail sector, not as strong as what we were seeing earlier this year. So that's slowing down, indicating that, yes, consumers are spending. Spending hasn't fallen off a cliff, as what we heard some predictions from folks earlier this year. But it's clear that people are becoming more choosy, which I feel like goes to the point that Kate was making, that is a sign that the Fed wants to see. That's a signal the Fed wants to see.
Staying on retail a little bit, you know, this is such a weird environment in trying to predict what consumers are going to do. You talk to a lot of folks in this space. How are they adapting to this kind of environment where even consumers are figuring out how they're going to be spending?
Right. When I chat with retail executives, they're very convinced that people still want to spend. Maybe they don't want to spend on dressy clothes or clothes for work. So they're trying to figure out what categories are people spending on and can they start offering those categories. So recently I went out to San Francisco, talked to Banana Republic, which is really known for like their professional dress. That's not a category you're seeing as much growth. So they're starting to sell beds because you still are seeing somewhat growth in home decor. And you're starting to hear retailers being just more creative with their strategies, starting to offer things that people might not think of them for, but that people are spending on.
Kate, what other data points might they be looking at that maybe the rest of us aren't paying attention to?
Oh, good question. This is a question for the press conference, right? Fed Chair Jerome Powell always comes out after the meeting, and you know, reporters were always trying to get him to say, "So, what are you really looking at?" So, I mean, another metric that that I didn't mention, and they've talked about it a lot, but average person might not be as attuned to this, is job openings, right? So, one thing that they've been saying for some time, and the reason why a number of Fed officials think that they can still get inflation to come back down without causing a recession, which is what has happened historically when the Fed has raised interest rates, is the economy, there's a slowdown and a downturn. This time, they think they can avoid that because they're saying that job openings had been so historically high in the wake of the pandemic. And so their rationale is this post-pandemic period is so different. This recovery and expansion has been so different than previous economic cycles. They think that actually a lot of employers, you know, have had trouble finding workers. They've had trouble, filling these openings. And so rather than laying people off, they might just start with getting rid of some of the openings that they've had and hanging on to some of those workers out of concern that maybe they're going to need them. It's going to be difficult to hire them again. Even if there is like a shallow recession and a downturn, they don't necessarily want to cut back as much as they otherwise might have. So the Fed is looking for that vacancy rate to come down. And so far, you know, it has come down. I think it's been the labor market generally has been more resilient than they expected. The unemployment rate is still very low, but they're hopeful that it won't have to rise too much in order to curb inflation.
Kate, I'm hearing resilient. I'm hearing strength in the job market. I'm hearing consumers are still spending, and yet everyone seems to be, you know, in the Fed and elsewhere, going out of their way to avoid saying that maybe we're getting this soft landing. Why is everyone so afraid?
Oh, they don't want to jinx it, Kimberly, right? I don't know if they're really that superstitious, but I think that certainly that, you know, the Fed has been burned before, right? I think they were burned back in the 1970s when they got stuck in this period of backing off of their rate hiking campaign. They thought that they had conquered or done enough to conquer inflation only to stop and then have to restart again. They saw prices reaccelerate. So they're very, you know, wary of that dynamic this time around. And there have been periods over the last year or so where, you know, we thought that prices had turned a corner and people started sounding more optimistic and thinking, okay, maybe, you know, maybe this is it, only to see them, you know, ramp back up again. So I think that even now we are getting some good news. There's certainly a lot of enthusiasm. It feels like, right, everyone in markets suddenly talking about this idea of the soft landing. Are we in it? There's a lot of, a fair amount of evidence, reasons to be optimistic, but I don't think you'll hear it coming from the Fed for quite some time. They're not going to declare mission accomplished until they're really, really, really sure.
Jordan, I feel like the game of are we going to get into a recession is now being swapped for are we going to have a soft landing. What are consumers feeling? Are they on the edge too?
Consumers are spending on what they want to spend on. I was even just chatting with folks today about like Barbiecore. Like, yes, we're going to the movies and let us buy all of our hot pink. So I think that is this evidence that, you know, that is a normalcy that we haven't seen in the past few years, and people are confident and not just spending on non-discretionary. But the other, there is another headwind that we haven't really talked about. We're going through lots of labor movements this summer. There's the possibility that UPS might, or the Teamsters at UPS might go on strike, and that would definitely cause an immediate impact on the retail industry that consumers would feel right away.
For sure. Jordan Holman at the New York Times and Kate Davidson at Bloomberg, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, it ended mixed because I think everyone's just waiting on the Fed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shifting to the global economy now, Wheat prices soared this week after Russia withdrew from an agreement that, for the last year, allowed Ukraine to safely ship grain through the Black Sea to global markets. And after attacking one of Ukraine's main hubs for agricultural exports earlier in the week, Russia is now warning that any ships sailing near Ukrainian ports could be considered military targets. Ever since Russia invaded Ukraine last year, the market for wheat and other grains has been pretty fragile. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more on what these latest developments mean.
Ukraine was the fifth largest exporter of wheat in the world before the war. Jack Scoville is vice president at Price Futures Group.
Ukraine was 7% of the world's market, so it's a significant player.
Russia's most recent set of attacks on Ukrainian trade are reflected in prices for wheat. Chicago December wheat futures jumped more than a dollar this week to peak at about $7.65 a bushel.
I don't think that the world wheat market has nearly enough supplies in storage to kind of counteract this.
Globally, year-end stock levels for wheat are expected to be low.
They're probably the lowest since 2007-08. Which was a time when we had very, very high prices.
But Joe Glauber with the International Food Policy Research Institute says the outlook for wheat seems more stable than it did just after Russia invaded Ukraine last year.
The good news is that we have actually had pretty good production in the rest of the world, despite these problems in Ukraine.
Higher production elsewhere means there's less concern that the world will run out of wheat, says Naomi Bloom, senior market advisor at Total Farm Marketing.
We are in a situation where everybody can breathe a little bit because we'll have enough to get by.
At least for now, although another geopolitical escalation or weather disaster could change that. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Now, on to that housing data I mentioned at the top of the show. The National Association of Realtors said existing home sales in June were down about 19% compared to last year. Now, that's not because people don't want to buy. It's because people with homes aren't selling. So that makes new construction all the more important. Which brings me to another housing stat. The number of permits to build new single-family homes increased in June to the highest in 12 months, according to federal data. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that one.
Wake County, North Carolina is hot right now. Literally, yes. It's been in the low 90s today. And metaphorically, approximately 62 people are moving there every day, according to county data.
Think about that. That's a day.
Cheryl Merritt owns a real estate firm in the area, so it's her job to help those newcomers find homes, which has been challenging with inventory on the low side. This is a problem all over the country. But with home prices high, National Association of Realtors chief economist Lawrence Yoon expects there to be plenty of new construction.
Builders are building more. I think they will continue to build more given that there is a financial incentive.
And scarcity, points out Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at the real estate brokerage Redfin.
There is a real dearth of supply. We built fewer homes in the 2010s than in any decade, going all the way back to the 1960s.
But, she warns,
it's going to take decades of building, not just one good year, for the market to come back into a healthy place.
Back in North Carolina, realtor Cheryl Merritt is counting on interest rates ticking back down, which she thinks will encourage more people to sell their homes because they'll feel they can afford to trade up.
It's amazing how these little fluctuations give people hope to where they come back in the market.
And that's essential for more people to be able to buy homes and realize the American dream. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up,
best pony ever.
And who didn't want a pony growing up? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 2 points, basically not at all, to close at 35,227. The NASDAQ fell 30 points, 0.2%, to end at 14,032. And the S&P 500 added 1 point, again, pretty much nothing, to finish at 4536. For the week, the Dow added 2.1%, the Nasdaq dropped almost 0.6%, and the S&P 500 picked up 0.7%. The price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil closed up 1.9% at its highest in almost 3 months. European Brent crude added 1.8%. And what do you know? Shares in oil and oil-related companies moved accordingly. Chevron pumped up 1.5%. Halliburton gained 1.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.83%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Among the many changes to the planet due to global warming are changes to what can grow where. Take, for example, wine grapes. Unstable weather, rising temperatures, and drought are affecting some of the most popular and well-known wine-growing regions. But for vineyard owners who've been sticking it out in cooler, wetter climates for decades, the heat brings new business opportunities. Emily Hovick has more.
At Winery Aufrecht in southwest Germany, staff are getting ready for a busy Saturday crowd. Owner Johannes Aufrecht shows me around.
We're just entering the winery, and then we're heading to the cellar.
He's expanding and improving this family business.
Some fresh paint. We're awaiting some new machinery.
The vineyard sits above Lake Constance, roughly 1,600 feet above sea level. It's gorgeous here, with a panoramic view of the sparkling blue lake. It's also cool and rainy. 30 years ago, wine growing was almost impossible here.
Most of the years were too cold to get nice results in grape growing.
Now the warming climate has made it easier to ripen grapes in this area, and even opened the door to new varietals.
We can do sparkling wines, from barely ripe grapes up to heavier styles of red wines.
In the past, cool climate growers like Aufrecht struggled. Now they're at an advantage, but there are costs to the changing climate, too. Hail and unpredictable weather are expensive to manage.
Despite the fact that it has been getting warmer continuously, there's still a lot of variability.
Hans Schultz is president of Geisenheim University in central Germany. He says despite the erratic weather, the overall warming trend is good for wine in cooler places.
We can grow grape varieties now which we couldn't grow 25, 30, 40 years ago.
Researchers have tried to predict the impact of climate change on the global wine economy. One study suggested a rise of 3 degrees Celsius could translate to profit increases of 150% in Western Germany. Other regions will lose money. But either way, Schultz says growers will need to prepare for change.
Grape growing, I always say it's not a coral reef. We can adapt.
Across the Atlantic, wine regions in the northern U.S. also stand to benefit from a warmer climate.
There's a lot of new opportunities that are becoming available because the season is seemingly being pushed longer now.
Bree Stock owns a consulting company called Constant Crush Wine in Oregon's Willamette Valley. This cool region is known for its Pinot Noir, but Stock encourages her clients to try growing new varietals.
Syrah, Cabernet Franc, Gamay Noir all ripen 3 to 6 weeks later than Pinot Noir does.
Stock is seeing new growers from warmer regions like California and France now buying land in the Willamette Valley, where they're counting on having a longer horizon.
People who are coming in have young children who they're hoping to, you know, pass the vineyard down to.
As iconic places like Burgundy begin to struggle, Stock says the Willamette Valley and other cool regions can fill the gap. Oregon and Germany make up a relatively small portion of the global wine economy, but they're both growing. In 2021, for example, German wine exports hit a 20-year high. Back on Lake Constance, Johannes Alfried says his winery is part of that trend. He's selling more and more wine throughout Europe and the U.S. these days.
I will see a huge opportunity to gain international reputation. The possibilities are endless.
Alfried knows his region will eventually face more extreme weather. But for now, he's looking forward to a few decades of sunshine. On Lake Constance in Germany, I'm Emily Havik for Marketplace.
There aren't a lot of reasons to look forward to letters in the mail these days. It's mostly bills and junk mail, right? But sometimes you go to check your mail and you find something there that can change everything.
So I go to the mailbox and it was packed with letters. And there's a little note, you know, from the post office saying, you know, your mailbox is too full. We couldn't put everything in. Would you come to the counter to get the rest of your mail? That's when I knew this was going to work.
What was going to work was an effort to save a cultural landmark in the town of Chincoteague in the Virginia Barrier Islands. And Cindy Faith was on the receiving end of thousands of letters.
Please accept our donation to help save the BB Ranch.
It's not much, but praying it helps.
This check is to help the BB Ranch and the legacy of Misty. I only wish I could give more at this time.
Chincoteague Island, BB Ranch, Misty. Generations of kids learned these names reading the Misty of Chincoteague books, a series started in 1947 by Marguerite Henry and adapted into a 1961 movie about the wild ponies that live on a nature reserve just across the channel on the island of Assateague. I visited the Museum of Chincoteague Island, where Cindy Faith is executive director, and where they actually have, carefully taxidermied, Misty, who was a real pony that lived on the island until she died in 1972 in the care of the Beebe family.
So originally, Clarence Beebe and his wife Ida, they owned a ranch that was well over 100 acres. They also had many children, I think 12 or 13 kids. And so when they passed away, you've now divided this property up amongst them.
Now there are just 10 acres left, owned by siblings Barbara and Billy.
And neither of them are physically or financially in a position where they can just hold on to the ranch. Barbara's in her 80s. Billy is turning 70. It is time for them to segue into the next phase of life.
Rather than sell to developers, they asked if the museum could, pony up the cash to buy the ranch for $625,000.
So that's where they just kind of put it out to the public and hoped and prayed.
Cindy set up a GoFundMe, and donations started trickling in, and people sent those heartfelt letters and cards, sometimes with just $5 to $10. She has a drawer full of them in her office.
A minute or two to get to a good one for you. I grew up on the shores of Maine reading all of the Misty books and wishing I had my own pony. Today I do, a 16-year-old Chincoteague pony named Ranger, best pony ever.
Between those and the online donations, plus some large grants, in just a few months, the museum raised enough to move ahead with the sale. And by the day of closing, Faith estimated more than 5,000 people contributed to the effort.
Thank you for having us.
Hey,
On the day the museum officially bought the ranch, siblings Barbara Gray and Billy Beebe were full of memories, including their own cameos as extras in the 1961 Misty movie.
And I was 6 years old, not a professional actor, of course, and I know they took them scenes about six times.
Were you in the movie too?
Yes.
What role did you play?
Keep him straight. Mama said, don't let him get away from you.
The siblings said selling to the museum was the best possible outcome.
Our mother would be proud of us. Yep. I'm glad she didn't sell it because Daddy wanted to buy more racehorses.
I remember that.
I do too. Mom refused to sell that last piece of land.
Yep.
Billy already works with the museum to do short tours for Misty fans and has his own house next door to the ranch. He'll keep caring for Misty descendants Angel, Drizzle, and another pony, Pearl. Meanwhile, this weekend, saltwater cowboys will start rounding up the famous Chincoteague ponies ahead of their annual swim across the Assateague Channel to Chincoteague Island. And thousands more visitors will have a chance to see Misty's descendants and the ranch, which will eventually be folded into the museum experience. This final note on the way out today, the reason those saltwater cowboys swim those ponies across the channel to Chincoteague every year is to check on the horses, of course, but also to manage the size of the herd by auctioning off some of the 60 or so new foals born every year. That auction is coming up this Thursday, and the proceeds go to support the volunteer fire department in town. If you're interested, you gotta get there early, and expect to drop at least $3,000 to $10,000 for one of the famous ponies.
Marketplace is supported by Amazon Business, helping provide a smarter, easier way to get the supplies businesses need to thrive. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying. And by the new Glassdoor app. Professionals can now join real anonymous conversations within their company, industry, and communities and get answers about careers on Glassdoor.
Today's moment of economic context is pretty relevant during the Women's World Cup, given their fight for equal pay for better work. Axios reports the pay gap between full-time working women and their male counterparts is now the narrowest on record. Women's median weekly earnings in the U.S. are just over $1,000. For men, a little under $1,200. Still a ways to go, but progress. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will be back on Monday. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.